This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with conservation specialists relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and across America. I'm your host, Jay Shell. Our guest today is Bob Crabtree, Executive Director of the Yellowstone Ecological Research Center in Bozeman, Montana. Bob is the founder and the chief scientist for YERC, which is the abbreviated form of the organization, and he holds a PhD from the University of Idaho in wildlife and range and forestry. He's a systems ecologist, and he founded Yellowstone Ecological Research Center in 1993. So, Bob, welcome. It's good to be talking with you. Yellowstone Research Center is a unique approach to studying the environment. So, would you tell us about that?
Thank you, Jay. I'd be happy to. I always like to kind of say that politics usually trumps science, and it's frustrating for a lot of organization and agencies. So we really strive to be a truly independent, objective, nonpartisan, open and transparent research and monitoring organization. And we kind of our not-so-hidden philosophy is to, like Aldo Leopold used to say, to think like a mountain, only we try to think like an ecosystem and bring in the perspective of the other 10 million species on Earth.
Uh-huh. So you have a vision to forge a new, what you call a new ecology. What's that vision?
It's what I think conservation biology or conservation science should be. And I guess a short story probably tells it better than I could explain it. I ran with my colleagues in British Columbia a workshop about the future of conservation biology, and we invited my friend and colleague, Michael Soule, considered the father and grandfather of conservation biology. And I also want to mention that we lost Michael a few months ago. The workshop was about what lessons have we learned in the last 30 years, and what would we have done differently? And by the end of the workshop, as he was riding with me to take him back to the airport, he said, "You know, Bob, I know you're trying to retool and revision your nonprofit. I think you ought to adopt this idea of adaptive ecology," which is what I might have named conservation biology 30 years ago if I knew what I knew now. So it really is a well-reasoned problem-solving approach because, you know, nature is dynamic. It changes all the time, whether we like it or not. And it's about how we humans can adapt to the ever-changing unpredictability of the ecosystems that we rely upon ourselves. So we take kind of what I call a downstream planning approach to identifying those problems and really forging solutions that are science-based and based on evidence and common sense.
So you established the research center in 1993. You founded it back then. And what was your vision then, and has it changed at all?
I guess we've added a fourth pillar, which is that term adaptive ecology, because we need information to make decisions in a timely manner in order to keep up with all the unpredictability and changes that are going on. The first three pillars that we built the organization on are long-term research and monitoring, large spatial scale studies at large landscapes across ecosystems, and also collaborative partnerships because, you know, we're kind of losing the battle here and the health of the Earth's ecosystem is not that good. So we really need to all work together and find a way to do that. And I like to say that, you know, science is the ultimate arbiter, and I'd rather sit around the decision-making table and argue over the data and the information than about personal opinion and politics.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So those are the four pillars that we believe in. And we decided on that, Jay, because, you know, I'd say about 90% of the research done, at least in the U.S., is done by grad students at universities for about 2 or 3 years. That's the average time of a biological, ecological, outdoor study of nature. and the average plot size is several meters. So, you know, what do we really know about a 10,000-year-old stream in Yellowstone or a 30-year lifespan of a grizzly bear with a very short-term study that is based on a very small area?
So you're a private organization, and you must have people who hire you to do your work. Is that correct?
Yep. We use grad students, postdocs, volunteers, an army of field technicians that come and work for 3 to 6 months to further their careers and try to get a job and get ahead in their careers by really getting some hands-on field experience on how nature really works, because it's like a doctor taking care of a human body. You know, to do a quick serum parameter test isn't quite enough. You've got to monitor your patient and become very involved with that patient in order to sustain health. And that's our philosophy of all our field work, is you really got to get out there and experience how nature works if you want to try and fix things.
So for whom have you done work?
Oh, gosh, in the 27 years, we've received most of our funding from the federal agencies like the National Science Foundation, NASA. We've even had Department of Defense contracts doing remote sensing, which is a great tool to study large areas like ecosystems and landscapes. And then, Department of Interior agencies too, like the BLM, the Park Service, Forest Service, and Geological Survey. And then also, foundations, and we're moving now toward more private funding sources, because we believe in what the Leopold ethic is, which is really about you've got to work with private landowners and producers in order to have conservation success.
You talk about the need to adapt and adopt a new Hippocratic Oath for the ecosystems. What's that mean?
Ed Wilson, or some people know him as E.O. Wilson, who is still with us today and still writing books, is the first person I know to really lay it out. And he said, it's just like the Hippocratic Oath for doctors, do no harm. But nature's a bit different than a human body. It's much more complicated and operates at a much more chaotic set of factors that are very hard to understand. You know, you can say we have a lot of technology to study the human body, but we don't have a lot of tools yet developed to study large ecosystems and large functioning watersheds. So we like to think of that as a great way to communicate our Hippocratic Oath. So it's not just about doing no harm, but it's about restoring and maintaining. For example, Paradise Valley, where we do a lot of our work, is really a functional extension of Yellowstone National Park. So, you know, there's a chance there to restore and maintain these degraded lands that are sometimes healthy. So we have to define something we call a well-normal state, which is an analog to human medicine. And we really love the idea of what we call preventative health care for ecosystems. And I don't know if you know about that term, but it's something that insurance companies grappled with for decades, and they finally saw that if you put money into preventative health care, you actually save money in the long run as an insurance company, and the patient benefits too.
Your website talks about forging a new ecology, and you talk about adaptive ecology. Tell me more about that.
Absolutely. We like to quip about the old saying, in God we trust, all others bring data. And at York, we flip that a little bit and say, in data we trust, all others, God help us. So we humans are the perpetrators, and we do a lot of good, and sometimes we do harm. We need to learn from those, I guess I would like to say, policy experiments. We can also learn from natural experiments like disturbance events and climate change and flooding and catastrophic fires. But we need to learn from all that and then do what we adhere to, which is called downstream planning. And it's really an idea borrowed from Stephen Covey, a business philosopher, you might say, And it's like getting in a boat and floating down the river. And as you float down the river, you learn about the problems from case studies.
Sure.
For example, a landowner that does enough water for irrigation.
Mm-hmm.
And then you think about all the tools and traditional techniques that are possible to solve that problem after you define it. Then you get downstream and you start rowing back upstream, gathering all the right tools, information, and monitoring techniques to really prescribe a fix that's sustained and that people are involved. We use the term community science, so it's beyond citizen science. It's how state and federal agencies, private businesses, landowners, academia, and NGOs all really work together to gather the data upon which decisions are made. And only then, I think, can we trust in the data and have it become useful information. You know, because at this day and age, especially this year, we see that no one really knows what is true about research and science. So we have a real credibility crisis, and I think community science is that solution. So that's kind of how the adaptive ecology really works, is it's the old adage of really trying to work together and seek common ground.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So enumerate for me once again, what are the center's four pillars?
Long-term studies, 10 years or more, to take advantage of these natural and policy experiments. Study things at multiple scales, and particularly large scales, because environmental problems occur at very large scales, whether it's in spread of invasive weeds or climate change or pollution. We have to study things at large spatial scales if we want to restore our systems, our ecosystems, and then work together in collaborative partnerships, seek common ground. And then the fourth one is adaptive ecology, how we humans can adapt to nature that's ever-changing and very, very dynamic, hard to predict.
So in looking at long-range kinds of collecting long-range information, that involves a lot of information accumulation and back referencing and so on. So how do you manage to store and keep and refer back to all that information you've collected?
That is the million-dollar question, which is about the size of the price tag we have on developing what we call our internet platform. It has a lot to do with this new discipline called precision ecology, came out of the world of precision ag, where new technologies are combined with traditional tried and true technologies to gather and manage incredible amounts of data. So there's another new discipline called data science, and it deals with this problem of big data and how do you curate it, how do you process it, how do you learn from it. And what really binds it all together to make it work for us is developing standardized, long-term, transparent, open monitoring, and then learn from that monitoring data as various impacts occur, like pollution or a fire or a change in land use activities, and learn from it and adapt to that change. And then the hallmark of really all good science is, can it predict? So we're using precision ecology to try to develop predictive models. And it's kind of a science jargony term, but think about it this way, Jay, is we all know how important weather forecasting is. And after World War II, society kind of demanded accurate weather forecasts that at the time in the 50s were about 50% accurate. But we worked together. We put out sensors. We developed models. And everybody kind of worked together. And now 36-hour prediction is about 90% accurate for our weather. Mm. We're trying to do the same thing in ecology, whether it's predicting animal movements across corridors and landscapes, or water temperature, or amount of water available, or how a habitat might respond after a fire.
So are you looking to restore ecosystems as they were found when Europeans first entered the Western landscape?
That is a subject of much controversy that I believe is starting to come into agreement that we have to go back in time to whatever impact occurred in that watershed or ecosystem we're trying to recover. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in Paradise Valley, which I'm sure you're very familiar with, mm-hmm. you know, we do have some good information on what it was like before European man showed up in the 1860s. So right there, it's very helpful to learn about what the well-normal state or the historic range of variability is from about 1800 to 1850. And we do have tools and techniques to do that. And then we use that to help guide our restoration attempts. So yes, I really think the future of the Yellowstone ecosystem is about making it an open model for the world and all working together to really kind of brood over the data, set up long-term monitoring like a doctor would for a patient, and then create prognoses. You know, what can we do to restore? What can we do that works? How can we find incentives for landowners to join in and this idea of coexisting with wildlife rather than trying to control it?
So on your website, you identify several net projects: RiverNet, WildNet, LandNet, YellowstoneNet. What are those projects?
Those are all people and monitoring networks, from human sensors to sensors you put in streams to measure temperature and discharge, to sensors you fly on drones or remote sensing satellites, or in particular cell phone apps that are very well equipped with a GPS and a camera. Nice. and a data portal. And so we combine all these different techniques to monitor the landscape and arrange it by kind of what we call the three domains that have to do with the pressing issues in the different watersheds of the Yellowstone ecosystem. You know, one is the water quality and quantity, hence RiverNet, WildlifeNet. Mm-hmm. So that's a network of people concerned about resolving human-wildlife conflicts, including road crossings and depredations on crops and livestock. And then LandNet, which is the terrestrial surface. And it has a lot to do with predicting how we can best restore lands after a disturbance event, whether it's humans or more natural. And then finally, YellowstoneNet, which is our platform I described earlier, our internet platform called EPIC, another acronym, and people, the people that inhabit the watersheds of the Yellowstone ecosystem that really care about all these, solving these problems.
And what is the Canine Ecology Project?
The Canine Ecology Project is probably one of our signature projects. And really is kind of at the basis of why I chose to start a nonprofit 27 years ago. I left my postdoc early at UC Berkeley because I was lucky enough to get two big contracts to do research in Yellowstone National Park. Mm-hmm. One to predict how the great fires of 88 would affect predator-prey systems, and the other one was to build the wolf model to predict how introduced wolves would affect elk sport hunting as well as the elk populations in the park. And this was in 1991, you know, before the wolf reintroduction. And, of course, I jumped into these 2 and 3 year studies and then soon realized, oops, I need to do long-term research. So I was lucky enough to be able to raise a lot of funds to do a study on coyotes, wolves, and foxes and all their prey. Over a 20-year period from 1990 to 2009. So we called it the Canine Ecology Project and really took advantage of, studies before the wolf reintroduction and then looking at the system afterwards and how wolves have affected things.
So of the various studies that you've done, is that the one of which you're most enamored or proudest?
Oh, probably. I was lucky enough to do my PhD work on a coyote population in an area in eastern Washington that was the first study to ever been completed on coyotes in a natural state where they weren't subjected to human mortality, you know, killing and trapping and aerial gunning and all that. And I learned a lot. I learned that, you know, the policies of then the animal damage control was completely flawed and all based on politics and really nothing to do with science and information. And in fact, I'd like to joke about an old trapper saying, kill one coyote and two come to its funeral. Mm-hmm. And basically the science supports that old saying. Mm-hmm. You know, so often what we do is ineffective. And if we really try to understand how natural populations and natural ecosystems really work, call the mechanics of nature, we really can use that information to forge effective policies that are based on, like I say, evidence, common sense, and best available science. And I really learned that when I worked at Hanford, and I had a chance to kind of bring that knowledge to the Yellowstone ecosystem, which is, you know, a very iconic place. You know, that was the model for the world, and it still can be if we focus on restoration and in addition to managing and protected areas. But we have to essentially preserve and protect and maintain our protected areas like wilderness and national parks. But in order to save biodiversity and all those ecosystem services that we need as human beings, we have to focus on private lands. That really is the future, and how to restore them and maintain their health.
Uh-huh. So, is the research work that you do, is it just confined to the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, or do you do work outside of that area?
We are reluctant to work outside the area, but yes, we are. I'd say 95% of our work is on the six large watersheds that radiate around the core areas of the Yellowstone ecosystem, you know, which are the two big national parks and the wilderness areas of the Forest Service lands.
Right.
So we really try to, you know, renew the model and keep it up to speed as it was in 1872 when we had the foresight and Congress had the foresight to create, you know, what's said to be the world's first national park. But bringing into the, you might say, the 21st century of what we call precision ecology, which is an applied version of adaptive ecology, where we really try to monitor, diagnose, and prescribe forecasts of how to do things right and maintain the health and improve the health of the Yellowstone ecosystem by restoring populations and restoring habitats that wildlife rely upon.
I think you said that you use interns, you have intern positions. Are there some available currently, or when do they become available?
Most of our field intern positions are spring through fall, and we take anywhere from 5 to 10. We also work closely with trying to hire locals in the watersheds we work in and work with all the other organizations there. So sometimes we even find volunteers for those other organizations we're partnering with. And then we also work with a lot of students, undergrads and grad students at Montana State University, since it's so close here to our headquarters here in Bozeman. And we also have a field station right now in Paradise Valley. And we also have a mobile system that can move around the ecosystem as need be in trailers.
So what kind of work do volunteers and interns do when they're out in the field?
Hands-on, get dirty. Look at carbon content in soil pits.
Uh-huh.
Do bird surveys and point counts and identify birds. Measure riparian vegetation. Track radio-colored animals, develop new camera trap applications to monitor wildlife populations. Those are some of the things we're doing this summer.
I see. Okay. And your field ornithology volunteers, they're out in the field counting what, specific species of birds or or population numbers? What are they doing?
Yes, it's one of the most well-respected and you might say rigorous techniques out there to monitor or examine indicators of ecosystem health, kind of like the canaries in the coal mine. And these are bird point counts where you have to know your bird calls. And so we need field ornithologists that are birders, and there's a lot of them available. And so you go to a location and you stop and you get quiet, and then you identify birds by auditory cues, singing males,
mm-hmm.
and also visual observations, and then record how many of those breeding males are singing, and you can convert that into good estimates of population abundance or density, which is a particularly good diagnostic because it's sensitive to change. For example, you fence off a riparian area to keep cattle off of it, which many ranches in the West are doing as good holistic range health management practices to regenerative, restorative ag practices. Often you can see a response in yellow warblers or willow flycatchers within 1 year. So it's a particularly good technique.
And you have people who go out and set cameras. How many cameras do you have out in the field at any one time?
We have a pilot study right now where we have six cameras out to try to develop what we call a wildlife camera trap cooperative. There's a lot of landowners that have camera traps. It was a technique developed out of the, sport hunting industry, and it's a great one.
Right.
And there's a lot of new techniques and new camera technologies that we're experimenting with this year. So we have our staff and our volunteers swap out the data card every week, and we're looking at developing ways to monitor populations by looking at the cow-calf ratio and the fondo ratio for deer, and also be able to apply machine learning. We're working with Microsoft's AI for Earth program to identify deer versus an elk versus a bear, so we can automate monitoring and inventory on private and public lands. We're working with the Forest Service on that. They've been very cooperative.
And do you issue publications resulting in the work you do?
Sure. Yeah, we probably have funded the generation of about 200 publications over the past 27 years. You can find a lot of those on our website.
Okay.
Also, a big believer in publishing on the internet and popular science outlets. And most importantly, our EPIC platform. We believe that getting the data out in a quick turnaround time called real time or near real time may be the best way to publish information in a mechanism other than scientific peer review. So everybody has access to the data and all stakeholders can make decisions in a timely manner. And that's something that as wonderful the attributes and amenities are in academia and federal agencies and NGOs, it's something that we really need to work together on because the public is really demanding it. They want access to information that they can believe,
mm-hmm.
and they want it in a quick turnaround. For example, sometimes an agency is so burdened because of budget cuts, they can only sample once a year, and it takes them a year to get that information out to landowners and stakeholders. It's like a coronavirus test that takes 2 weeks to get the results. It really is an effective use of technology.
And so what is the Research Center website?
It's www.yellowstoneresearch.org.
Well, Bob, we've exhausted our time, so appreciate very much your talking to us, and hope we can do it again. Our guest today Our guest today has been Bob Crabtree, Executive Director of the Yellowstone Ecological Research Center in Bozeman, Montana. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to our website. Just search for Wilderness and Wildlife or go to jswilderness5.net or to kgvm.org and scroll down to Wilderness and Wildlife. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Shell.